Hi everyone, I'm Burns Hargis, and welcome to the Inside OSU podcast. This week's podcast explores the complicated relationship between the United States and Russia. To give us some insight, we talked with OSU alumnus Glenn Howard, who is the president of the Jamestown Foundation in Washington, D.C. In our conversation, we talk about Putin and Trump and the 2016 elections. Glenn also has a fascinating description of what Russia was like back in the 1980s when he lived there. Here's our conversation with Glenn Howard. Let's start a little bit with your background. You grew up in Okmulgee.
That's right, Okmulgee, Oklahoma.
And then came to OSU.
Yep, I came here and studied business and then found an interest with a dynamic professor teaching in your language program. It got me excited about Russia.
Is that right? Yeah. Were you taking Russian?
I started taking Russian, and he said, my goal is to train you so that we can drop you behind in a parachute into the Soviet Union and no one will find and be able to detect that you're an American. So that sold me on it the day that I started taking it.
How long did it take you to get to that level of fluency?
A year and a half, and then they steered us through intensive Russian language programs in Indiana University, and then I qualified for an exchange program, and I went there for 4 months and ended up staying 2 years.
Wow. What were you doing over there?
Well, I worked as a part-time employee at the U.S. Embassy. I was working also, at that time in the Soviet Union, you couldn't just go there and live. You had to have some type of official sponsorship. And so I found this through the embassy and was able to stay there and travel a lot and walk the streets of Moscow and learn what it was like, you know, in the Soviet Union, which was a fascinating.
What years were they?
That was in 1984 to 86.
So that was before Glasnost and
that's all before
revolution.
That's right. That was a crucial time when they were shifting. Something new was starting to emerge, and it was the tail end of the Cold War, and it was a very exciting and interesting time.
What was it like, just life in Russia then?
Well, it wasn't the image that was portrayed in the West. I mean, in other words, there was an image that the government was trying to portray to people that free medical care and that people were taken care of, and I think the immense poverty and the lower, it was just shocking to me. I mean, things that, you know, where you're wanting to get basic food like eggs and bread and things like that, which were easily available, but that was about it. I remember one time I gave a Russian friend a pineapple and they'd never seen a pineapple before. And so those little small things were shocking, and you know, the Russian people are very warm, very friendly, but they're also very suspicious of foreigners. So that was a thing for me that was really eye-opening, and it reflects the importance of trying to understand languages and culture to be able to communicate and understand their perspective, because if we can't understand their perspective, then we will have problems in misreading their intentions. Yeah. And I think that's whether you're right or left, you know, everybody agrees with that view. And I think Reagan showed that, you know, he could go to Reykjavik and meet with Gorbachev and went against his advisors. But again, his approach was peace through strength. But I think that the United States now, you know, when I was in Moscow, it was just a very different eye-opening experience. And I was able to travel around the country quite a bit. And it was a very interesting to see the different countries that are now free and independent, like Ukraine and the Baltic states. I went to those areas. And it's shocking now for me to see the vast difference in what they were then and what they are now, and that their aspirations for their own independence, you know, to be free of Russian rule. And so, and I think Russia has to adjust itself change its behavior as a nation, as a country, in terms of how it deals with the West and its own citizens. But it was strictly at that time in the 80s was the most fascinating. And I highly recommend the show, TV show, The Americans, because I've been very impressed with how real that show is.
I'm an avid viewer.
So we're all sad to see it go.
I know. I'm just in the sixth season, and we're so don't tell me what happens.
Yeah, okay.
But they're just now going into it. You know, Gorbachev's nuts. He's going over to the.
But I think that when you look at that show and how they use certain sets and things from the Soviet period, it's strikingly real for me. Yeah. I was it brought back so many memories for me.
Yeah,
and
it's pretty pretty true to history, and well, you do get their perspective.
That's true, and I don't want this to be a totally negative conversation about Russia and how I view it, because I think Russia has adjusted, and now economically they can get many of these goods from the West. I mean, they're importing Norwegian salmon, you know, and American chickens in the Far East are being brought in. So there's a lot of things the way that have changed in Russia in terms of how they supply, how their style of living has vastly improved over the Soviet period.
You've been in Washington for many years.
That's right. I've been in Washington since about 1999. I've been president of the Jamestown Foundation for over 16 years. So starting in 2003, I became the president. And so really enjoy the job.
Well, tell us about the Jamestown Foundation. How are you?
Well, the Jamestown Foundation was
funded.
Well, we're funded by private donors. There are several foundations in the United States that are conservative foundations that like the mission and role of what Jamestown does. At the end of the Cold War, there was a great demand for information, and when the Soviet Union basically kind of fell apart, Jamestown had to kind of reinvent it ourselves. So what we established our name and reputation for was working with defectors. So many of the well-known Soviet defectors that came to the West, we helped them write their memoirs. So when the Cold War ended, we shifted over to becoming more information-oriented, and now we publish information on our website about terrorism, about Russia and China. So we kind of cover some of the major threat areas that of concern of U.S. national security.
Do people buy your research?
No, it's free of charge. Yeah. So all our publications are free of charge. We have a certain board members. Frank Keating used to be a board member, former governor of Oklahoma, which we're very proud to have. And so we have a certain percentage of our revenue comes from board members paying contributions, and others is from basic fundraising and drives that we do to raise money. And the other come from foundations. So we don't accept any U.S. government funding, so we're very free and independent and can speak our minds.
Well, this must be the salad days for you with all the issues with Russia and interference with elections and Syria and all the rest.
Well, certainly, as they say, Putin is good for business. So,
yeah.
So that's really helpful to what we're doing in terms of the level of degree of interest, and we publish daily information about Russia and the regions adjoining Russia called the former Soviet Union. And so we're unique in that regard that we provide this information. It is free of charge, but we have about 15,000 subscribers all over the world, people in the U.S. government, other governments subscribe to it, and even the Russian government reads it and sometimes doesn't like it. And we've actually they've posted two demarches, diplomatic notes of protest about our activities, and we've actually been knocked off the internet a couple times because of the Russians didn't like us. So we were very much victims of Russian internet hacking and attacks.
Jamestown Foundation.
Jamestown Foundation was. I mean, we've had several times we've been attacked, and we're very much in their gun sight, so to speak.
Do you know whether the hacking is by the Russian government or by operatives? Or?
Well, in cases where this happens, they call in the FBI, and the FBI does an investigation, and they were able to determine that the attacks on our website came from very insecurities routes through other parts of the world, but were traced back to Russia. And it's also the Chinese as well, also a little bit unhappy about some, because we have a very well-known publication on China.
So, well, then you'd have a particular insight into this alleged Russian hacking of the U.S. electoral system.
I would say yes. I mean, we weren't surprised.
Yeah.
So this was something that we had been tracking and monitoring for quite a long time, for several years, and we, even before this happened, we ourselves were attacked, so this was nothing new. But I think what surprised so many people was the range and extent of the attacks, and even now with the most recent elections in the U.S., there's been the level recently was unprecedented, even before it surpasses the previous level. So
you wonder if they're involved in the Broward County stuff down in Florida, or maybe Florida.
Well, I wouldn't go that far, but I certainly, you know, there is a trace, and I think that what that underscores is that, you know, we packed up and went home after the Cold War, and I think that they kept focusing on their capabilities and improving them, and still want to be a rival to the United States, even though we don't really consider it that way. And some people consider Russia to be a pale shadow of its former self, but it's not the Soviet Union. They're not 10 feet tall. But they are very aggressive, and they certainly want to push hard in some areas that affect our national security. And certainly many Democrats in Congress are outraged by it. And so I think that there's a great level of attention, but, you know, because they've been focusing on modernizing and doing some things with their military and also with their internet security, I think that Russia is a very determined power to try to fill some of the regional security vacuums, and especially the vacuum that was left in Syria. They were very determined to fill that. So this has led to, you know, certainly a recalculation by the United States of what the threat posed by Russia to the United States is, and no one's suggesting that we're going to go to war with them tomorrow, but it's a much elevated threat risk than we're used to seeing.
Well, it's an interesting kind of diplomatic dance going on for a casual remote observer like I, because on the one hand, President Trump seems to have some kind of a rapport with Putin, and yet sanctions have been assessed, although I'm told not as many as actually could be legally. And you've got the problems in Syria, and you got the problems in Turkey and in Yemen, and we just look a little schizophrenic in our policy.
Well, certainly it's not coherent in many ways, because I think the United States is now trying to focus on the economics of national security. And I think that by focusing more at home and rebuilding the United States, I think that has led to kind of the level of attention is not as high, but it's certainly important, because you can't be strong militarily if you're not strong at home economically. So it's a certainly difference in thinking.
What is the economic situation in Russia? I mean, if you take the oil sales out,
that's true.
There's not much there, is it?
Well, no, there's very rich in natural resources, you know, some of the richest in the world, but it's also, anytime you look at the map, I mean, Russia occupies a very vast space of all the way from the European parts of the Baltic and the Arctic all the way to China and the Pacific. So. And its very population is having some severe demographic problems. The population is dying, getting old, they're not replenishing. But there's still this level of resilience in the way the Russians outlook on the world, but they don't have their own Silicon Valley. And so militarily, when you can't produce enough missiles, or certainly cruise missiles that don't have the sophisticated technology in it, that's going to affect your ability to continue to be a major power, which is what they're striving for. I wouldn't say they're there yet, and that's part of the problem what the United States is trying to deal with in Europe. At the height of the Cold War, we had 360,000 men in Germany. Now we have 50,000 men for all of Europe, and so it's a vast difference in what it used to be.
You'd be far more knowledgeable than I am on this, but I kind of understood that the rapprochement by Kissinger to China was brought on, or willingness to accept that was brought on by China, was brought on because of the strength of the Soviet Union and what they were doing. Now it seems not that Russia is actually kind of partnering up with China against the U.S.
Yeah, that's certainly, they're trying to multiply their bargaining power, and they do this rhetorically. So they do this often, speaking in a way and trying to show off their ties to China in a way that to make the United States weary of you know, not wanting to challenge Russia. But I think the United States is, and I think China too, has its own kind of global agenda of things that it's trying to pursue, and that Russia is just a kind of a casual partner in those efforts, and I don't think there's a real deep inner drive for alliance against the United States by the behalf of the Chinese, but I think it does play into how they look at the outside world. And certainly Russia wants to manipulate and use that for itself because it's not what it was in the 1980s. So they know that, but there is this complex that Russia has where they have to feel and assert themselves in a way. And I think that U.S. policy made a fundamental mistake by trying to cater to that. And because when they catered to it, the Russians misinterpret it. So I think that's, you know, as Reagan said, peace through strength. It was a very, is the appropriate way to respond and to deal with Putin's Russia. And I would say one thing that's interesting is that President Trump, for the Russians, when you look at how the Russians look at Trump, they have a hard time figuring him out. And they,
a lot of people do.
Yeah, that's true. But a lot of people look at it and say, well, he said all these nice things about him. He's flattering Putin all the time. But when it comes to our words and deeds, it's not reflecting that. So they're kind of put off base a little bit by Trump's behavior because they can't figure it out. And in some ways, that adds to our benefit because they're more cautious in how they're dealing with the United States because they still retain this hope that Trump will one day strike a deal with them. And
what would the deal look like?
Well, the center of this is discussion of Ukraine and the Russian invasion and annexation of Crimea in February of 2014, followed in August by their invasion of Donbas, which is a part of eastern Ukraine. So we want the Russians to pull out of eastern Ukraine and retain Ukraine's territorial integrity. And that's where all the negotiations have been. And the Russians have just basically, kept repeating the same thing, kept meeting and negotiating, and nothing was ever happening.
So they're supposedly protecting their Russian.
Well, that's what their claim is. And so Europe initiated sanctions against Russia over this. And so that's kind of where we are. But, you know, Putin is more of a person of the 19th century. What he reflects is more of this idea of a status for Russia as a great power, but at the same time he knows Russia doesn't have the capabilities of what it used to have, and so therefore his weaknesses. He knows he has weaknesses, and part of the problem is the West always kind of caters to that, to his. To our concerns, the view, let's not start World War III with Putin, and we got to get along and get to know him. But at the same time, he's taking bits and pieces of Ukraine, and there's been over three wars fought in the region since he's come to power. And I think that this is, there's a drive and determination that you haven't seen by a European leader since Bismarck. And on one hand, I very much dread and fearful of Putin, but on the other hand, I very much respect him as a leader on the global stage of someone that's trying to get what he wants for Russia. But the problem is that there's others getting in the way. And we all remember the tragedy of Poland in the 1930s when he fell to Hitler and Stalin. So there's countries that border Russia that are very much susceptible to influence.
When we think, though, about diplomacy and you get into the mutual benefit kind of analysis of economics. I mean, so we're really there with China. We really can't live very well without them, and we can't live with them in many respects. And they're the same with us. And so it would be a real shoot yourself in the foot event for either of us to take unusually strong measures against China.
Well, the view in the Department of Defense and the view of many American defense policymakers is that China doesn't really pose an immediate threat to the United States militarily. Whereas Russia does, but the long-term threat to the United States militarily and security is China, and it's obvious through its economic strength and wealth accumulation. But Russia in the near term is a power that's what they call an irredentist power that's determined to redraw borders according to its whims. So this is kind of the problem that we're falling into, that how the United States deals with this at a time.
Because we really don't have any economic interests in Russia particularly like we do in China.
Well, we do with the Arctic and the natural gas and the energy development. Certainly we do there. And obviously there's a lot of McDonald's in Russia, and they're enjoying and actually expanding as well. So the problem is the end of the Cold War kind of redrew how we wanted to think about the world. And we started talking about these really nice terms like soft power and we can influence countries by sanctioning them. But ultimately, at the end of the day, we always see the sanctions never really work. And only the low-level people are the people that are hurt by this, whereas the rich and the people, the Saddam Husseins of the world, never had to suffer. So we had this kind of mindset because we were the last remaining superpower, and we kept thinking that we could bend people to our will. And I think that and people like Putin and others, I think that, you know, was determined that the world would not go according to the U.S. whims and what we were wanting. And so I think that this is, we need to kind of readjust our own mindset to this.
What does the Jamestown Foundation recommend our policies
well,
be?
Well, I think we like to be neutral, and we're nonpartisan. So we have Dems and Republicans on our board. We are conservative, but we do have a conservative outlook, and we've, you know, definitely have been talking about the threat posed by Russia for quite a while. We don't provide opinion. So what separates others in Washington is Jamestown likes to provide you with the facts. So we're reporting with data and figures and things that make people want to learn. It's educated information, not dealing with opinion, because everybody has an opinion, but there's very little facts. So we feel this niche in Washington, and we provide that to people. And so we don't really have an opinion about, we don't form policy papers and say you should do X, Y, and Z. But in my own existence as working as president of Jamestown, I think the perspectives that we have is that there's certainly when you leave certain portions of territory around Russia and not say that you're willing to defend them, then that's like putting a bullseye on those countries. So there has to be a certain level of U.S. deterrence. And this is a phrase that they lost since the end of the Cold War. We haven't started using that word, but this administration has started using that word, and I think that's the proper term, is deterrence, to build up and militarily let the Russians know that we won't let them walk over these countries and that we're willing to help them.
So what should we have done when Skripal was and his daughter Yuri were poisoned?
Well,
what should we have done?
Well, certainly you're not going to go.
If the sanctions don't work.
Well, certainly you're not going to go to war over this, you know. But this has been a threat to the British intelligence services. They've killed several Russian agents, people that have defected to them. And when a person comes and defects to your country, you want, and you're giving them that other country your secrets, you want to know that when the minute you walk out to your car or go home, that you're not going to be knocked off. And so what this signified was a war that Putin is waging on the home turf of the British intelligence services. And he's waging this war as a way to send a signal to other defectors, do not defect and do not betray your motherland, because if you do, we're coming after you. So the larger context for this is really the signals that it's sending, and how the Brits are going to respond to this is going to be a challenge, because they haven't done that to the Americans. And I don't think they have the capabilities to, but in Britain, there's a lot of Russians have immigrated and moved there. It's much harder for them, for the British intelligence services to protect people. And it's a real challenge for them. And I don't know what the real answer is to that. I think that the level of retributions of kicking diplomats out, you know, that doesn't do anything for Putin.
Just eyewash.
No,
yeah.
No. In the Cold War, the rule was you take out one of ours, we'll take out one of yours. And they haven't resorted back to that tit for tat. But at some point, you know, this is the third poisoning in Britain. At some point, this is going to lead to some type of retribution by the Brits. And so it's a very serious challenge.
Now, do you have other issues that you're tracking across the world?
Yeah, we are. We track, we're all following, ironically, we're following issues like in Africa and North Africa. We're following some of the terrorism issues related to the Islamic State that was in Syria and Iraq. So we very much closely follow Al-Qaeda. Jamestown was one of the first nonprofit organizations in Washington 2 years after 9/11 to create a publication dedicated to analyzing Al-Qaeda. And ironically, 2 years after 9/11, there was nothing in existence in terms of publication that dealt with al-Qaeda and bin Laden. And I'll tell you, here's something else you could take home to your wife, tell your wife tonight, that Jamestown made up 40% of all bin Laden's library were Jamestown books and publications were from Jamestown.
Wow.
So 40% of bin Laden's reading shelf came from us. And so this is an official declassified study information that came from the U.S. government. They did an analysis of everything they found when they raided his compound. So we're quite proud about that. That bin Laden, the things that we're putting out was being out there in red. So, and that's because much of our analysis was by people who speak Arabic.
Yeah. So, you're here for the Global Briefing series, so you'll be briefing our students tonight. And what can you give us a synopsis of your message?
Well, the synopsis, there's two aspects. One is to talk about Russia and impress people, make them think I know everything in the world, what's going on. But the other part is growing up in Oklahoma and striving to go on and do something else. Mm. And the important part is to know that you can make a difference. And you can go from Oklahoma State University to Washington, D.C., and through hard work and networking and just learning something like a language and commanding and mastering it and making a difference and setting yourself apart from that. And that shows that anybody can do it.
Yeah.
And that's going to be part of my message tonight. The other part is, you know, don't let people from the East Coast tell you that you can't make it in Washington.
We are proud of all Glenn has accomplished in Washington. As we mentioned, he was here as part of our Global Briefing Series, which is sponsored by our School of Global Studies and Partnerships. The series started after 9/11 for the purpose of educating the public about developing events in the U.S. and abroad. You can watch Glenn's Global Briefing Series presentation on O-State TV. Just go to ostate.tv and enter Glenn Howard in the search. And that's this week's Inside OSU podcast. We'll be back again next week. For now, I'm Burns Hargis, and thanks for listening.